to mention, but I knew I was pushing myself on time. I'm glad you asked the question. We are now beginning to see, if we didn't already know, the dysfunctionality of global privilege as Americans, particularly for those who are, and not even as Americans, because we expropriate that term, it applies to a lot more than the U.S., as citizens of the United States, who have such enormous privilege worldwide. And as a result, you know, the president wants us to believe that people hate us because they hate our unique freedom, or whatever, as if they are at all aware of that based on the way we have treated their people. So, of course, they're not. The real issue is that they experience our privilege, and more importantly, they experience the flip side of it, the oppression that has allowed us, as Perini talked about last night, you can't get rich without very poor people. You can't get wealthy without exploiting resources. And they know that, even if we don't. And so now you're beginning to see that those persons who experience the downside of someone else's privilege can and will take matters into their own hands in a very dysfunctional way. It's clearly not going to move any agenda of justice to do what the folks on 9/11 did. It was not about that, and certainly if bin Laden's behind it, he's not at all interested in justice, and al-Qaeda's not interested in justice, and you know, these are reactionary forces. But the reality is that that is the kind, I mean, we are not an island. We are not able to always be safe any more than that suburb is. And the more that we think, A, that we are impenetrable, B, that we are such a benign force in the world that why would anybody hate us? It's the same thing a lot of folks in the suburbs who think, you know, we create all the jobs. We're the folks with money. We create jobs. We give to charity. Nobody would hate us. Well, you know, it just doesn't quite work that way. And so I think on a local level, I've written about it a lot. I'm working on that now as a global issue because the level of privilege and what we have to do to obtain that privilege is very dysfunctional for issues of peace and international security, and really in the long run will only perpetuate more terrorism, both from us as state terrorism and then from others as reacting to that. So you're absolutely right, it's an excellent point. Yeah.
I've been an organizer for about the last 20 years. I've been an organizer for the last 20 years. And as you said before, there seems to be a pernicious racism or denial in terms of white skin privilege. I've been involved in the anti-globalization movement, a variety of movements back in the 80s and 90s. And it seems to me that a lot of people are trying to defend their position in society unconsciously.
Right.
They do not want to make there's some malice, in fact, it might be latent malice,
right,
that they don't want to make that primary issue, anti-racism, right, or to address their whiteness.
Right.
I also see a number of class issues. I went to Prison Industrial Conference in New York, Critical Resistance East, and it was primarily white.
Right.
Sweatshops have been, programs is primarily white.
Right.
Their outreach is pathetic. And I talk to these people, they have a lot of class issues.
Right.
Even back when I dealt with death penalty issues back in the 80s.
Right.
And my question to you is, it seems to me that there's some, but there is a pernicious underlying current. I went to an anti-war demonstration at the end of October, the end of September. And it's a pernicious underlying current of white, upper middle class, right, suburban type of thing,
right,
who are into a particular thing for a particular length of time.
Right.
And my question to you is, and me and I've had this particular experience, that it seems to me that there is a level of hostility or resistance,
right,
whether it be latent or overt,
right,
to pushing this as a primary agenda in all these particular realms.
Right.
And how do you dissipate this particular hostility or agenda, especially when it comes from white people?
Yeah.
I've struggled with them on numerous fronts,
yeah,
and even though they claim to be progressive in mind, this issue seems to be very, very a brick wall.
Right, right. Well, I think that we have to, it's a very long-term struggle and question, but I think that in the, you know, immediately what people who are involved in organizing must do is prioritize not only racism within the substrata subject that they're working on, whether it's globalization, environment, whatever, and make that analysis important, because making that analysis central will show a certain seriousness to people of color that otherwise is lacking, and that alone is going to help build, in many cases, a movement. But more importantly than that, we have to be willing and ready to prioritize leadership of color. And this is something that's very difficult for dominant group members to do. because we are so used to, whether it's in the corporate world or the educational world or even the sort of social justice movement world, sort of running things, because we experience privilege even within these movements that are technically about undoing privilege, right? So we have to be willing to follow leadership of color, and we have to recognize when we are, in fact, perpetuating our own privilege. I have to be very cognizant of this as someone that speaks around the country, knowing full well that my voice is amplified by my skin color. Absolutely, no question about it. So I have to try and ground myself in communities of color, working with people of color, getting input from them so they can check me in the work that I do. My feeling is we ought to go forward with this particular mindset, and if this makes our work harder and makes it take longer, then that's just what it does. That we ought to recognize that when we look around at a movement meeting and we don't see but only a smattering of people of color, we ought to respond to that just as viscerally and as with as much concern as we would if we looked around and all we saw was men. If we looked around and all we saw was men, we would know there is something really wrong with this. Likewise, we ought to look around and say, if all we see are middle class people, you know, who are economically, there's something wrong with that. That unless working class people of whatever race and unless people of color are in the room, we don't really have a movement, and we shouldn't be even trying to build one on that basis. Now, one might say, well, hey, we don't have time. We got to get busy. We got to do whatever we can do now, and maybe we'll, you know, we build it and they will come. But that's not the way it works. That's the way that people say it, but that's not the way it works. And people say, well, but we can't afford to wait. Well, you can't afford not to if by doing it the old way, which is, you know, letting whoever's there run the show, and who's that mainly going to be? It's mainly going to be people from the dominant group, dominant class, et cetera. That's going to create as many mistakes down the line and render your movement worthless, so that it is worthwhile to do whatever. And if people of color aren't in the room, then you better sit down and figure out why. And if it's because those issues aren't prioritized or because those leaders are not in the room, you better change that and act as if you can't go forward until you do it. I mean, you know, it's hard to do because we want to get busy right now. But, you know, here's the deal. Dominant group members and non-dominant group members, in racial terms, whites and anyone else, view social change very differently. People of color are fully aware that it's a long-term struggle. They're fully aware it took a long time to develop this system. It's going to take a long time to undo it. As much as they would love to see it done by tomorrow, they also have a much more realistic assessment. Those of us who are dominant group members, again, because of our sense of the way society works and the notion of entitlement and expectation that being dominant gives you, we want it done next week. I had a conversation with a young woman once at a school I spoke at where she came up and she said, and I'm not saying she's indicative of all folks like her, but I think there are a lot of people who feel this way. She said, I really want to get busy on this racism thing so that I can then go on and save the rainforest and then I can get out and start a business, you know, before I have to sell out. And this attitude is one I would never hear from a woman of color or a man of color. There's no way. This is something that only a fairly privileged person could have said, because she really felt that it was just a matter of, hey, if we put our mind to it and we just, you know, get together and work on it, we can save this, and then I'll move on to this, and then I can sell out later, you know. And that was her thing. So we have to be willing to say, you know what, this is long term. It isn't going to get done by next week. And because it's long term, we do have the need to take our time and do it right. We'll be more effective in doing it that way than if we go forward full steam now with an unrepresentative movement, and then we find ourselves down the line not being taken seriously by the very people who we have to have in that coalition. I mean, what that means is, until you have a movement that is truly representative, particularly of the community where you're working, you don't really have a movement, and you ought to have to go back to the drawing board and continue to try and figure out how to... Right. There is. There is a resistance to it, because even those dominant group members, yeah, it is a resistance and often a hostility, because we too, despite our politics, have internalized the belief that if you want a job done right, not only do you do it yourself, but you find somebody who you figure can do the work, and what is that person going to look like? Well, our culture tells us it's going to look a lot like me. You know, it's going to be somebody who is, you know, and I've had people email me and say to me, you know, well, what do you think about these movements that they just sort of foist people of color out there in leadership roles who don't really have the experience. I said, no, you've got it exactly wrong. That if you don't find leadership of color, I said, you know, is it possible that a particular leader of color might screw up something? Well, of course, just like it's possible that a lot of white, like myself doing the anti-apartheid work, I screwed up. I was this white guy, didn't think I had to address it, and I screwed up, and we weren't successful at what we were trying to do. So there are going to be mistakes made no matter who's running the show. But we as white folks have to be willing to let those mistakes be made and those successes be made by those people who have historically not been part of that movement. And if we need to do it, that means our movements have to do some very explicit anti-racism work within our own organizations, within ourselves as individuals, to address why it is that we continue to have this mentality. Because it is there. But I think that, you know, those of us who are fairly conscious of that and cognizant of that, we have to be, as white folks, we have to stand up in those meetings and within those contingencies and demand of other white people that they take this issue seriously. And what's good about white privilege is not much, but one of the good things is, if you're white and you have that privilege, you have the power within that kind of contingency to stand up, to make that kind of comment, to demand that the movement be representative racially and in terms of economics and gender and everything else, and be taken seriously. I can say that in a room full of organizers and be taken seriously. You can say it, and because of racism, won't be. And that's the problem. So those of us who are white, it's amazing how much power we wield if we're willing to step out of our comfort zone that says we don't want to deal with these issues. So within these movements, we have to step out. We have to be truly strong allies. We have to prioritize it and demand that other white people prioritize it too. And if we do that, the fact that we do have a certain amplification of our voice can pay off, but we have to be repetitive. We have to do it over and over and over again.
And I agree with you that, you know, it's kind of really pathetic that, you know, we are, you know, racially much less, you know, like representative than the U.S. military and multinational corporations like Nike we are opposing. You know, we should do better than that, you know. And I just want to ask, you know, a couple of questions, you know. And, well, I think that, you know, and to a certain extent, you know, that you have been preaching to the choir. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, and very, very, you know, and I don't know, liberal people, you know, who really sort of, you know, respond to you very well on the question of, you know, like white privilege and things like that, you know. And but if you sort of, you know, go out to, you know, talk to, like, you know, what I would call maybe regular apolitical white mm-hmm. people, and if you tell them that, you know, that you have, you know, lots of white privileges and lots of, you know, white advantages, then they think, oh, that's good. Let's keep right. them. Right. You know, and these are the people who can be kind of guilt-tripped into doing something. You know, these are called right. kind of liberal, progressive type of people, you know. But then all the white people, you know, not like that. You know, so, right. And I'd rather that you emphasize, you know, that big picture question, you know, like tell them that, you know, like, okay, those folks who cut affirmative action would also cut your wages, and, right, you know, build right, prisons right. and put right, you in right. prisons too, you know. And right. because there are things, you know, some rhetoric, you know, for instance, the rhetoric of the critique of, you know, white privilege, that would work to this crowd, you know, work right. with this crowd, but that wouldn't work with, you know, people who are really, really need that economic, you know, privilege, you know, because right. when there's competition, you know, well, you know, if you are really competing for, you know, one job and with like 800 people, you know, any privilege you need, you will keep it, of right? Course, you know. So we need the different way we're talking about it. I like your big picture talk, and probably right. better than white privilege talk, because white privilege talk will only work with this bunch of people.
Well, let's be clear. Yeah, and I agree with you. And here's what I would say. Of course, I give a different talk in this room than I would, you know, to a lot of other rooms. And it's about knowing your audience and adapting. But at the same time, I do think it's perfectly valid to talk about racial privilege in any group of white people, so long as you follow it up, which is what a lot of white privilege, you know, folks don't, people who talk about that a lot and the sort of analysis around white privilege have not done, which is to follow that up with the analysis that I offered there at the end, which is, you know, yeah, you have certain relative advantages, but in the end, this isn't good for you either, and here's why. And then you can talk about building a shared victim identity between white people and people of color, and explaining the various ways in which racism and institutional racism actually damage most whites as well. To not have that piece would be absurd to any group that wasn't already more or less the choir, although I will say, you know, I'm from the South, and I've been around a lot of choirs, and a lot of them don't sing on key, and they don't sing from the same hymn book, and they think they're the choir, but oftentimes they aren't. So even in a group such as this, it is still important to say the things that I said, because a lot of times folks think that they know more than they know. Sometimes I think I know more than I know, and then I go to a talk by somebody else and I learn something, even though I'm technically the choir. But even having said that, the point of talking about white privilege, it's important because it's a reality, and we need to be first and foremost about telling the truth. But part of that truth is also, because your point is well taken, that most people are encouraged to keep their privileges. So the only way to get them away from that, you know, we can either lie and act like there is no racial privilege, but that's not honest. Or we can say, yeah, there is, but, and here's why you ought to be willing to relinquish that for the sake of equity. And then there's a laundry list of things, some of which I talked about, some of which I didn't, but I'm working on a book on it right now that will sort of help make some of these arguments. And so I think there's a way to talk about privilege, but not the way that a lot of anti-racist commentators have, because they've only gone sort of halfway. You know, look at how much privilege you have. And at the best that's going to get you is guilt. And guilt is not a very good motivator for social action. You know, you have to go beyond that and to show white folks how they're damaged by it. And when I wrote that piece on school shootings, for example, that went out in March that received so much national attention, I had emails coming in. I got 8,500 responses to that piece. I answered 4,000 of them, read them all. And out of the, it took me 3 months to do it, out of the half of them that were white people, it was amazing. You know, this was, if some of you read the piece, like the first line is, I can think of no other way to say this, so here goes, white people need to pull our heads out of our collective ass. Now, that is not, that's not subtle. That's not subtle. And so some people didn't like the tone. What was interesting was, though, that still 60% of the white folks, and the point of the piece, if you didn't see it, was, again, what I was talking about, that white folks let down their guard to danger because they think it's black and brown and poor, and then what do you know, it shows up in their community, and they weren't ready for it. 60% of the white folks who identified themselves as white agreed with this analysis, and some of them were these suburban families from Littleton, from Santee, from Springfield, who were writing saying, my God, this is exactly right. We thought we were totally insulated, totally protected. This is a completely dysfunctional lifestyle we're living. My God, why did we move out here? I had teachers saying I felt much safer teaching in the city schools than in these suburban schools because these kids, you know, come in here, these white males from these upper middle class families think that nobody can touch them because nobody can. And so they were telling, you know, they're like, this is exactly right. This is so true. I'm going to take this article to the PTA meeting. I'm going to take this article to my church. I'm going to cut out some of the bad language and I'm going to read it. You know, I'm going to take the people, families were sitting around the dinner table talking about this article that I had written. So, I mean, that to me, and why? Well, because even though I'd been pretty harsh about attacking white attitudes, I had done it in a way that said, man, I'm not mad at you. I'm mad for you. Well, I don't know, but here's what I do know. I know that the discussions that were taking place in these communities, that this has now become, there are a number of these communities that are now talking about the very same kind of programs and services that are, you know, to do nonviolent conflict training, mediation, peer mediation, that weren't being done in those schools because they realized, hey, they're not any better than anybody else. They're not any less prone to violence or crime than anyone else, and they need those skills as well. There were white parents who were talking about, you know, the need to discuss very specifically the racism that has kept other people out of their community and the dysfunctionality of a lack of diversity in their community. White folks that were writing saying, you know, they were going to immediately begin getting active on housing equity issues in their community because they realized that it's not functional to be in this white place where nobody else is. And so I don't know what's happening, but I do know that the first step to any type of action in a lot of those places is to hear the argument made. And every one of these, now people of color, my article was not news to them. I mean, people of color were writing me saying, you know, thanks for saying it. We've been saying it a long time. Nice job. Are you really white? We don't believe you. You know, this was, I mean, I got that from thousands of people of color. And so I had to send them a picture, you know, by email. But the white folks, to them, it was very new. I mean, to a lot of white folks, even those who were progressive and, you know, they were like, wow, I never really thought of it that way. And I'm going to do something with this. I don't know exactly what, but I'm going to do something. And so to me, that is evidence that if this understanding of the dysfunctionality of privilege were talked about more, not only in racial terms, but gender and sexual orientation and class terms, talk about the downside of it, that is the – and of course, you know, the left has always known that. It's just that we've tended to define the dysfunctionality of racism in very narrow economistic terms. So the traditional Marxist approach is, you know, it drives down wages, blah, blah, blah. That's one aspect of the dysfunctionality of racism, but it's not the only one. We have to talk about some of these very direct, concrete family impacts, community impacts, you know, what's going on in your neighborhood, what's going on in your school. And I think that approach, even though the white privilege argument is sort of a hard sell, that then comes behind it and allows people to hear it because now they realize, hey, maybe this isn't all it's cracked up to be, you know, and I think that's a very important part of the message. Yeah.
You've discussed the importance of affirmative action to a lot of really deeply rooted problems. Mm-hmm. There's kind of an issue I have with affirmative action as it's been practiced so far, which is that, you know, racial oppression is very relevant, very critical issue, and so is economic oppression,
right?
And which can also affect, you know, poor people of any race, including right. Poor white people in the Appalachians and the Deep South and so forth.
Yeah.
And yet I've never heard anyone even bring up the idea of affirmative action for poor people regardless of race.
Well, so I mean, those ideas concept. Are what we call full employment. Those ideas would be what we call, you know, not having this tight money policy that raises interest rates when unemployment drops too low. We may not call them affirmative action, but that's what really any effort to have truly full employment or livable wages or, you know, free education, free college education or whatever, or heavily subsidized at the very least, that would all fall under that rubric. And those of us who push for affirmative action on the basis of race and on basis of gender because of racism and sexism believe very much in those programs and obviously push for them. One of the problems with affirmative action in college on the basis of class Although, you know, if you ask most admissions officers, they'll tell you they do it because they can look at a transcript and they can see, yeah, the person might be white, but I know this school, I know the neighborhood, I know where they're from, so I realize they're coming from an economically oppressed background. And they do take it into consideration. One of the reasons they can't take it explicitly into consideration is because of need-blind admissions. And so you have this sort of, you know, you have sort of a conflict between, on the one hand, need-blind admissions, which says what? It says, we're going to either let you in or not before we even know what your economic status is. The idea behind that is we don't want... We, you know, if we know that you're poor, we might sort of work against you because we'd have to come up with a lot of financial aid for you. So that was the idea behind need blinds, which still exist at most schools around the country. If you don't know what someone's class status is because of need blinds admissions, it's hard to do class-based affirmative action. So we have to sort of make a decision. Do we want to take the chance that an admissions officer will do good class-based affirmative action and say, ah, this person's poor, maybe they're white, but they're still poor, let's let them in, or is that going to be too risky? Are they going to say, this person's poor, we're going to have to find 20 grand a year for them, maybe we just won't do it. There's this sort of, and we have to discuss that. I mean, I totally support class-based affirmative action, but again, we shouldn't, there are some people now, liberals in particular, who are arguing, Richard Kahlenberg and some others who've written books about this, that have said, you know, we ought to get rid of racial affirmative action and replace it with purely economic. And the danger of that, of course, is that people of color are oppressed not merely on the basis of their class status, and the same is true with women of all colors, but also on the basis very specifically of race. And so even African Americans, Latinos, indigenous people, and many Southeast Asians who are not poor, who are from what we would consider middle class families, are still disproportionately likely to be tracked into those lower classes, disproportionately likely to go to those schools that don't prepare you to take these various tests. And so we have to have all three. We have to have race, we have to have class, and we have to have gender, because all of those systems of oppression are very real. And that's important.
I just want to jump in and say something that I think speaks directly to the question that the person just raised. And I think you touched on it earlier when you talked about the progressive movement in this country. But the civil rights movement of this country that we went through from, I would say, after World War II up to the assassination of Martin Luther King, spoke not just to the issue of race, but also the issue of poor people. The issue of the people in Appalachia was a part of the movement, and it was as significant as it was the people down south or in New York or in a place else who were black people, and they weren't speaking about black people in Appalachia. The movements of the 20s and the 30s around coal mining just didn't speak of white coal miner. It speaks of poor blacks and all poor people in Appalachia. So when we get sidetracked into BACI and the reverse discrimination issues, we are missing the significance of the issue in this country when we speak about racism, that the black cause in this country have always been a cause for equity and justice for all people and not just for African Americans. So let's not be sidetracked by that racist mentality and racist thinking which still permeates that we're trying to create a society of some special privilege for those of us who have been stolen the last 400 years and have been exploited. I'm sorry to get in your program.
Comment, and I have a question. The first comment is, I'm glad this conference is occurring. I'm particularly glad that Mr. Wise is here. I was one of those 85,000 email respondents.
8,500.
8,500 email respondents that you got. One of those people that said, hear, I'm glad that you said it. I didn't question that you were white, because I know there are a few folks that are conscious.
Right.
But my comment is, and not having been part of the organization of this conference, I cannot speak in terms of an absolute. I'm just offering as a suggestion, because part of what's come up has been, why are there not people of color at conferences such as this? And I will say this more as a generic. Sometimes that is because there are certain assumptions made about communications getting out, and therefore people don't fully think deeply about the different avenues for communication. You can't just put an ad in the Columbus Dispatch and assume that everyone in the black community is going to read
right.
that ad, and more importantly, it's a point of validation. You may find that putting it in the black media, getting on the black radio stations, and even beyond that, what really has big effect in a lot of communities, including the Latino and the Native American community, is they want to see your face in the place. They want to know, mm-hmm. do you have enough guts to show up in their churches and their community centers right. and actually talk to them about the development of the conference and not just merely put an ad in the dispatch.
Right.
So there's some things that are just real basic, fundamental marketing stuff
yeah.
that you need to expand to some other levels. You also need to think about the venue. And despite all of the hoopla about Ohio State is the only university on the planet, truth be told, for the African-American community in the state of Ohio, and I suspect for a certain extent for the people in Columbus, I'm not a native of here, Ohio State has a really horrible, horrible reputation with the black community.
Right.
Therefore, and I can understand there's all kinds of logistical reasons, size, et cetera, but there are churches, there are community centers. There's even a, I forget the correct term for it, but there's a community satellite Ohio extension location that you can go to that's part of in some way connected with this if you're looking for low-cost venues. So even if you have a day or a portion of a day literally located in the community, again, do you have enough balls to come in our neighborhood?
Right.
We want to see if you can come here. We're not going to go over there to that particular school that has a standing reputation of being one of the most racist schools in the United States.
Right.
So that's just a comment. The question that I have has to do with I enjoy and appreciate your forthrightness. And one of the things that's been very disturbing for me, and I'm not a columnist, therefore I don't have that kind of a venue,
right.
but I've done some writing around what I refer to as the whitening of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that psychologically and emotionally painful.
Yeah.
As talking with one of my dear friends, who is also white, as she said to me, she's disturbed by the classism
right.
of 9/11.
Right.
And what's disturbing her is that the sympathy that's being garnered, the idea of who the heroes are,
right.
the images that are being used. In my area is visual arts, so I'm very aware of images.
Right.
All of the images, the advertising, the appeals from the Red Cross,
mm-hmm.
The commercial advertising that's wrapping itself in the flag. The first week, 2 weeks, we did see actual human interest. We actually saw live footage
right.
of people who came together. And for a nanosecond, even my cynical self said, maybe, just maybe, not that it's dead, but the backbone of racism has gotten broken here. Well, since then, I've seen we've gone right back mm-hmm. to the same thing. And the reason why I think it's important is the same thing that you're talking about with white privilege as being a systemic, and I will put forward as a psychological mental illness,
right.
is mm-hmm. one where we, by having this position of whitening up everything, seeing everything from a myopic lens,
right.
then it speaks to a general global perspective that has us running ramshod over everybody else, and then we get surprised when they turn around and slap us because we're standing on their feet. So I'd like to know if you could speak to, are there any people who are addressing the issue, who are challenging the media? Are there ways that we can do that and actually be heard? And what do you have to say about the whitening of 9/11?
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you know, the whitening of 9/11, I've written about to some extent. I've done about 7 pieces on the war and the events since that time, and I just finished up an 8th. And most of them touch on this issue of the way that the perspective being offered is a white, you know, it's the white gaze that filters the perspective. So whether it's the discussion of now we finally know what it's like, or whether it's the we're all in this together, or whether it's, you know, this kind of thing, that is all part of the whitening of the perspective. The fact that, you know, you could look at some of that footage of the firefighters, for example, and the police in New York, which is an extremely non-white place. I mean, it's a very colorful place to live, and yet, you know, the faces that you saw of these firemen and of these police officers were overwhelmingly white faces. So the faces of the heroism were overwhelmingly white. One of the reasons, of course, is because the hiring historically in New York for those positions has been extremely racist. And so, you know, we end up getting this gist of an overwhelming number of white heroes, and that, of course, has a certain effect. So, I mean, I think that that the whitening of 9/11 happens, whether it's our analysis of terrorism, again, what I talked about, not looking at terrorism from white folks the same way. The day that the bombing took place, for example, I got on one of the chat rooms of the National Alliance, which is this neo-Nazi group out of West Virginia, one of the leading neo-Nazi groups in the country, and here were these white, you know, supremacist neo-Nazis who were saying how wonderful the events of 9/11 were because, anybody that runs a plane into a building and kills a bunch of Jews is okay with me, and hey, even though these are Arabs and we don't want our daughters marrying them, you know, they're doing our job, that's good, you know. And they were saying things like, maybe this will wake our people up and this will make our job easier. And so what I found interesting about that, you know, here we saw repeatedly the playing of a videotape of a handful of Palestinians dancing in the streets of the West Bank, not representative of the Palestinian people by any stretch of the imagination, ostensibly happy because of the bombing, whether or not that's, nobody actually talked to anybody, they just showed a videotape, so we don't know what was really going on. Here you have these images of dark-skinned people happy at the death of Americans, who, of course, we typify. We assume it was a bunch of white people. Of course, in reality, it wasn't. A lot of people of color were killed in the buildings. But we didn't talk about these white folks and these neo-Nazi groups that were just as happy and who were basically saying, this is going to make our job easier. I would suggest to you that, you know, 2 weeks ago now, it's been 2 weeks, the FBI announced that their evidence seems to indicate that a lot of this anthrax stuff is not only domestic, but probably related to white supremacist, right-wing fascist groups. Now, how many times have you seen that in the news? I saw one AP story about it, and it has been buried since then. And we're not reacting to it the same way because why? It doesn't serve the same function. To have these, you know, nutcase white right-wing fascist groups doing this, we can't justify a big military buildup against those people. We can maybe, you know, pump up the CIA a bit, but boy, it's always better if you got a foreign threat to do that. So the whitening of it is by sort of assuming that we're all on the same page, that the only people who we have to fear are these dark folk who we need to pull off planes, etc., and not thinking about the fact that if I'm a neo-Nazi and I want to do something, now is the time to do it, because ain't nobody looking for me. They're all looking for the person with the strange name, the strange, you know, head wrap, the strange whatever, and that's, you know, going to be dysfunctional as well. So that's part of it. As far as the avenues for expressing some of, and getting some of this stuff out, you know, part of the problem, and we're seeing it here in the sense that the major media from Columbus doesn't appear to have taken a lot of interest in this conference, and that's not surprising. There have been huge demonstrations all around the country since the war began in the beginning of October, with thousands of people. I mean, 2,000 people within 2 weeks before the war even started. 2,000 people in Portland, Oregon. There have been as many as 10,000 in and around New York, all over the country. These demonstrations, and they're not getting a lot of media coverage. At least not in the United States. You're getting a lot of talk about them in Europe. I mean, the press anywhere else, you know, talks about this stuff, just not here. Now, what does that mean? It means it's going to be tough to get our message out. But here's the deal. At the same time that that is true, how are those 10,000 people getting together? How are those 2,000 people, if it's not on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, if it's not being talked about there, if nobody's announcing, you know, Bill O'Reilly's not coming on television and saying, there's going to be a demonstration at 7 o'clock, please join. You know, he's not doing that. But yet people are still finding out, okay, there's a demonstration, there's a teach-in, there's this, there's that. How are they finding out? Well, they're finding out through non-major media, non-quote-unquote mainstream, non-dominant media sources, which means there are avenues for us to get the message out. Now, it's going to take time, and ultimately, it won't be enough, because unless we get some major coverage, a lot of folks who don't log on to sort of progressive or alternative websites or don't listen to alternative radio or, you know, alternative television where it exists, not often, those folks won't hear it if we just keep it in the alternative sources. But over time, if we're already getting 2,000 and 5,000 and 10,000 people, which is many more that we're turning out, many more turning out now at this stage of this war than we're turning out at this stage of the Gulf War or at this stage of the Vietnam War, that is significant progress. That is something positive, and it means that we are finding little avenues to exploit to get information out. The internet, which I'm very cynical about as an organizing tool because it isn't a democratic forum, it's a small-d democratic forum, it isn't spread equally, it is both classist and oftentimes, in terms of who has access to it, racially biased as well, but it is there, and we need to learn how to use it. So whether it's, you know, I write for ZNet and I write for Alternet, and also my stuff gets posted on Indie Media and a lot of other sources. And these three sites alone, Indie Media, Alternet.org, and ZNet or ZMag.org, are three places that have, you know, are putting together sort of the best analysis, anti-war analysis that's out there. People are looking at this. ZNet is getting a million hits a week or something. It's just absurd. So there are people seeing this stuff, and you can then send that to other people. And it's just like the school shooting piece that I wrote, you know, was probably, I mean, It was just a simple article. I almost didn't write it. I sent it off on a whim, and within days, it had exploded. I got 8,500 emails, but that article on the AlterNet site alone, there were 100,000 hits on that website to read the article, and most people didn't read it through that mechanism. Most of them got it in an email tree. Most of them got it from a listserv. There are probably, we estimate, as many as 10, 15 million people who saw that article. Now, that is more than any sort of left or liberal columnist is able to claim in this country, and it was just this one article. So we need to continue to exploit that. We need to use those handful of internet sites and alternative sources, alternative radio, to get that word out. And over time, that movement will be built, and there will come a point where, as we build it, the mainstream media, quote unquote, will really have very little choice, but to, you know, because when you got 20,000, 30,000 people in the street, it's a little bit harder to ignore. So we just have to continue plugging away at those alternative mechanisms. And if you're writing things, you know, you need to be sending those things to those, you know, send that stuff to AlterNet, send that stuff to Indie Media, send that stuff to antiwar.com or whatever it is, send that stuff to ZNet. And it may not all get posted, but some of it will. Send it to as many places as you can and get that analysis out there, because it's all very, very important. And it is potentially a very useful tool, not the only tool. I mean, clearly, alternative radio, and this is so vital that we're here at this particular moment with the real Pacifica as opposed to the hijacked Pacifica. And it's very important, because the hijacked Pacifica, you know, WBAI in particular has been making use of an old interview with me over and over and over again, and they continually sort of, they love to do this. They tried to sort of position me a few months back as this white person who understood what they were all about, and, you know, they totally misread everything I was saying and everything I believed in, so now I refuse to appear on their station until they get their crap together. But that's something that we're going to have to be very clear. So all the things that you heard about at the beginning here, the statements about alternative radio and really independent radio, whether and everything BIX is doing, I mean, these are critical avenues for alternative thought, because if the only people who are being heard on some of these Pacifica stations are like Mark Cooper, you know, I mean, here is a guy who says the left is completely insane because we care whether Mumia dies or lives, because that's not a real issue, and who says, this is a guy who he was really cool in Chile in 1973, but it's sort of like, what have you done for me lately, you know? And this is a guy who writes a few weeks ago that the left is insane, that we're self-hating by being against this war. He makes these comments. One minute he sounds like he's against the war, the next minute he thinks the anti-war folks are just off their rocker. He's sort of taken it upon himself to determine who's a valid commentator and who's not. People like Chris Hitchens, who I don't know what the hell is his deal. You know, so I mean, you got Richard Falk, who's a longtime international peace expert, writing in The Nation that he thinks it's a just war. Now he seems to have gone back on that, but I guarantee you his retraction of that is not going to get nearly as much attention as his initial statement. So we've got to be constantly pumping up those alternative mechanisms, whether it's radio, whether it's television, whether it's print media, whether it's the internet, and getting the message out there, knowing that we can reach people. We don't have to rely, at least initially, and we should never rely on the dominant media. They're not there to do our bidding. We can control what is said in the media that we control, and we should do that, and we should democratize that to the greatest extent possible.
What an excellent lead-in for two plugs, Tim, that I wanted to make. And they're both with regard to Central Ohio-based and still continuing homegrown forums. One is originated October 1970, and I can say proudly, but I won't reveal who she is, a good long friend of mine helping to found it, the Columbus Free Press, one of the remaining continuous existing post-60s, underground, but still are here and free papers, www.freepress.org. I won't stand here and soapbox about it. I'm proud to be on the board. There are two other board members here. The other is the Community Festival, started May 12th and 13th, 1972, just off of 16th and High, and my friend Margaret, again, unfortunately jailed by the Red Squad people that weekend by someone who Dewey Stokes is one of our county commissioners right now, a red baiter. Anyway, I had an interesting observation and question for you briefly, because you were talking about the syndrome of people and white feeling of powerlessness when they find that they don't have all that power. And it was a reflection on LBJ. And I had some I don't feel so bad about him feelings, not about the war issue. Yeah. It was about his devotion, actually, because he wasn't a good old boy masquerading as a New Dealer and a civil rights man. I feel, learning from his writings, that he was actually a civil rights feeling person and a New Dealer mm-hmm. who had to actually act like a good old boy to get some things passed. And I think that part of the problem that we found was once he was no longer president because of the war and the way he screwed up
right.
things, and he didn't get the civil rights recognition and the black communities blew up,
right.
and he decided he couldn't run because Eugene McCarthy was so embarrassing in his standing in, I think, the Wisconsin or other primaries, that he retired to his ranch in Texas. He died an alcoholic, and in fact, I was down there for that counter-inaugural in
right.
January of 73, and when I woke up that morning, just before we were going out to demonstrate against Nixon's second term inauguration, what's on the cover of the Washington Post? LBJ is dead.
Yeah.
And LBJ, I think, died within one day or the other of when Nixon was inaugurated.
Right.
And just thought, if you wanted to reflect on that, LBJ is one of those people.
Well, I don't know. I'm maybe a little more cynical about how much he got it. I think he probably got it the way that most white liberal, quote-unquote, anti-racist people get it. I mean, he got it at one level. But, you know, if you go back... you can make the same argument about, you know, Wallace. I mean, George Wallace, if you look at his history, is no question about it. He intentionally capitalized on racism to propel his career and made a point of it. I mean, I still have a little problem for either Wallace or LBJ really saying that they were just, you know, these white folks who maybe needed, who had their heart in the right place. And I mean, maybe that's true, but here's what I guess I would say. I think that it's true that had the movement at that time been maybe more advanced than it was, and it was already doing such wonderful things and pushing for such wonderful things. Had there been more cover for somebody like LBJ, or for that matter Wallace, they might very well have taken different positions. There's no question that powerful people are able to do more if their intentions are good. They're able to do more the more cover they have, the stronger the movement is, and the more people in the dominant group who accept the movement. And of course, the reality was, despite all the images that we have that make us think sometimes that the movement was widespread accepted and that, you know, everybody was behind Dr. King. Of course, if you look at the polling data, that's wrong. The majority of white folks in 1963 said that King and the movement were pushing too far, too fast. They really hated SNCC. They really hated anybody more militant than King. So there wasn't a lot of support. And had those numbers been better, I'm sure LBJ could have done more. But I guess what I would suggest is that, you know, over time, if we're going to get politicians, whether it's, you know, in historical context or today, if we're going to try to analyze politicians and why they do certain things, there is no question that people in positions of authority will do whatever they're able to get away with. And if that means, I mean, not necessarily people of principle, they will do, if they can get away with taking a more progressive stance, they will do it. If they can't, they won't, no matter what their actual principles will be. And that's why it's really not so much whether or not, to me, it's not all that interesting or important whether LBJ really sort of got it but could only push so far. What is important is that the only way to guarantee the proper action, whether it's by him or whether it's by George Wallace or whether it's by Kennedy or whether it's by anybody, is to make sure that the cost of not doing the right thing are too high. So whoever it is, I'm convinced, for example, that with the exception of the most fascistic forces, David Duke, for example, Pat Buchanan, people who are truly, Duke especially, someone who's truly a fascist, truly a Nazi, I don't think any level of pressure, if David Duke, God forbid, were president, would change him at all, because he's truly an ideologue. But the reality is most people that get elected in this country are not of that cloth. You know, even Reagan, as ideological as he was, you know, he talked a lot of game before he became president, and then he didn't deliver in the eyes of a lot of the far, far right the way they wanted him to. Why? Because he couldn't. He couldn't get away with it. He wasn't able to invade Central America. Why? I mean, he waged one hell of a proxy war all throughout the region, but he wasn't able to actually launch an invasion force in Nicaragua and El Salvador. Why? Because the people stopped him. So the point is, no matter where you stand on the spectrum, unless you're truly just an overt fascist and authoritarian, like someone like Duke, someone who's truly about that, you can be prodded and pushed and forced in the right direction if the movement activity is strong enough. Because just as Perini said last night, it's not as if people are in the streets of America saying, bomb them, kill them all, you know, Jim Crow, way to go. You know, nobody was doing that. There wasn't this huge movement for oppression. But people do what they can get away with. And so you may be right about LBJ. I haven't read enough of his stuff to know. I know that I feel like he could have certainly been a lot braver a lot sooner, and I'm convinced that the only reason, frankly, the Civil Rights Act got passed was because, you know, the very time that it was getting passed, it was the middle of what was going on in Birmingham, and then 1965, the Voting Rights Act, because folks were getting beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and that was image-wise very bad. And Perini talked about this last night, too, that so much of this was the result of Cold War ambition and trying to project a particular image. So it's impossible for me, and probably anyone, to totally disentangle what a person's real racial views are from what they had to say, because racism is so embedded in the culture that even the best person sometimes will sort of play that card, play that game in order to achieve their own ends. And so I don't know. I guess the question is, to me, the more relevant question is, what are we doing to make sure that no matter where LBJ stands, no matter where George W. Bush stands, no matter where Bill Clinton stands, you know, whatever, what are we doing to push them in the right direction? Because frankly, I'm just as worried about Bill Clinton, you know, who comes to power and then talks a good game and talks about, you know, and Toni Morrison in some delusional moment can say he's the first black president we ever had, you know. Well, I mean, you know, he locked up more black people than any president in history. I mean, I don't know if that makes him black. You know, did an awful lot of things to harm people of color, and yet somebody who's respected as his icon can make this comment. And here's a guy who really didn't follow through on much of any of that. You know, he talks about having a dialogue on race but not racism, and then his own commission puts together a report that talks about racial privilege, and he scuttles it and doesn't release it. You know, so to me, I'd rather have somebody whose intentions were not pure but have a strong movement that could force the issue than to have somebody whose intentions seem good and then we all get lulled to sleep. Because so many people in this country thought, well, now Bill Clinton's president, you know, we can relax. He'll do the right thing. He's going to have black people at the White House. You know, he'll talk a good game. He'll go to a black church and he'll give a talk, and he'll even do it with a black affect in his voice. Why? That's wonderful, you know. And in reality, that is not that's not the issue. And so I think a lot of folks got lulled to sleep. We sort of cut him more slack than we would have, you know, somebody else. So to me, whether someone's intentions are pure or not, I just don't know. What we do know is that movement activity can create the cover for somebody to do the right thing if they're inclined to do so, and it can force them to do the right thing even if they're not inclined to do so. And I guess that's how I would answer that.
Oh, and thank you. I don't want to disrespect the next person in line. Just also to say that the community festival does have a table right by the registration right. table. And if you're with an organization that might want to have a booth at the festival, please come and I'll be representing that community festival. And there are plenty of copies of the Free Press if you're not familiar with that publication. Right. And I'm terribly sorry. Please go ahead.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for your articulate presentation. And I think it's an. I want to thank you for your articulate presentation, but I also think I want to also. Say that because racism is systemic and institutionalized, my privilege is a responsibility to not only educate, but to abstain from the power structures that sustain those institutions and those systems. And
right.
And I just want to applaud and thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. And as far as abstention, I mean, the key is that, I think it's important. Well, there are two things. I mean, abstaining from the power structure is important. Of course, at the same time, speaking as a white person to the power structure, which is so critical, is part of the white privilege that can be used against that white privilege. So it's also about recognizing that simply abstaining won't bring the system down because you have to also active. And I know it's not what you meant. Absolutely. Right, absolutely, yeah.
I know it's late, and I don't want to open up a Pandora's box here,
right.
But I'm afraid I will. But it goes to your first comments about first trying to be involved in the apartheid movement and then trying to think about how you need to connect it to local initiatives.
Right.
It seems to me that the events of September 11th have really forced us to think about how local initiatives have to be linked to international movements.
Right.
You have to be involved to act as watchdogs for the terrorism bill and the kinds of crazy
right.
things that it's going to do to people from other countries. I'm an international student here.
Right.
And I'm also personally concerned about being involved in the anti-war movement. But also, what is the future of Afghanistan?
Right.
And that you cannot anymore just say local movements and
right.
no international issues, and that we have to think in really creative ways to bridge the two. I mean, why do we even call immigration law anymore? It's
right.
just a really discriminating kind of economic, right. social policy. So I'm just saying that I think it's kind of like brought it to a head. And
it has, and the good aspect of that is that for once people are beginning to sort of be forced to realize that they're not able to ignore, you know, the government of Afghanistan or the government of Saudi Arabia or movements that exist in those countries. And we're so ignorant about that normally that, of course, election time, you know, the issues that are on nobody's radar screen, it seems, in America or in the United States are issues of foreign policy, issues of foreign economic development, anywhere else on the globe. I think we're now beginning to realize that we can't do that. The only problem, of course, is that the dominant discourse is still sort of assuming that we can control what goes on in those places via military force, via economic penetration, or as, you know, George Bush says, well, we'll just solve the problem. We'll hire a PR firm to do some ads to Muslims. You know, we'll run some advertisements and that'll solve the problem. And see, that's a very United States type business school solution. We'll get the best marketers together and we'll sell America to the Muslim world. You know, and I mean, I'm firmly convinced, frankly, that, you know, the Prophet Muhammad could be here right now and some Madison Avenue image pimp would hire him to sell PlayStations to the Taliban, but it wouldn't matter, you know, and it wouldn't actually solve the problem because in reality, we have so many issues that have nothing to do with marketing. It isn't just that, I mean, this is the impression people are getting. They're angry at us because our women wear miniskirts. They're angry because women have a vote and, you know, and that's not, you know, you look at what Bin Laden says on his videotape, he's not talking about mass pop culture. He doesn't care about that. He's talking about very specific issues. You can't just market your way out of 500,000 dead Iraqis, you know, dead Iraqi children. You can't market your way out of the illegal occupation of the West Bank. You can't market your way out of a Saudi dictatorship that we pump up because it's good for our oil. I mean, you know, you can't market out of that. And so we've got to begin, and you're absolutely right, these issues that we once thought of as exotic and issues we could think about if we wanted to are fundamentally about our own safety, our own security, regional destabilization. We have to know what's going on in Pakistan. We have to know what's going on in India. All of these issues are related, and that needs to become part of our curriculum in colleges. It needs, you know, so many international relations. Yeah, instead of just this mere focus on diversity, it's about an analysis that needs to take place, even in the room when it's not diverse. Because the focus on diversity sometimes leads us to not address the problem until the room is mixed. And meanwhile, the rooms are often not mixed, but we still need to be doing the work. And so in those, I mean, I remember I was an international relations specialization major within poli-sci, and the analysis being offered at that time by political scientists was this 30 and 40-year-old out-of-date, still very much rooted in Cold War thinking. There was no analysis about the region of the world that now our country is focused on. There was nothing there. So we've got to be talking about it regularly. It has to be part of all of the work that we're doing. We do have to care about, obviously, the future of Afghanistan, not only for the people there, but for those of us here who are going to reap the whirlwind of the policies that we are now following, which are certainly not going to make us more safe or going to make us less so. And I'd suggest to you that might be why we're doing what we're doing. There's a certain functionality to being afraid. And, you know, we're not bombing Saudi Arabia because we can't get away with it. We're not bombing Egypt because we can't get away with it. We're not bombing Pakistan because we can't get away with it. We're bombing Afghanistan because we can, because they can't fight back very much, and because we all rightly hate their government. I mean, their government is a horrible, oppressive system. So it's easy to get them. And it's functional because then we typify an enemy. We scare the hell out of people that these are the people who want to get you, and we don't solve the problem. So it does have to become part of our overall understanding. We need to learn a lot more, a lot faster than what our culture typically encourages us to do.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're going to have to cut it off.
That's
our
cool.
Our workshop starts at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
You guys have sort of missed lunch, so hopefully you'll get